Bob Harris Country on Radio 2, and our session tonight comes from the Dave Rawlings Machine, which is made up of the hugely influential Roots duo, Dave Rawlings and Gillian Welsh, alongside Ketch Secor, Morgan Janig, and Willie Watson from the Old Crow Medicine Show. We actually managed to really span the continents with this session, as we recorded the interview in Nashville a couple of weeks ago, and the music here in London a week later when the full band were over in the UK touring. So, the first live track from the band is the song which was nominated for Song of the Year at this year's Americana Awards. This is Ruby.
Ruby, let down your golden hair while I'm standing at the bottom of the stairs. Ruby, well, I can see a TV on, but the people they flicker and they're gone. So lick down your golden hair for me tonight. Lick down your golden hair for me to climb, just like an old time telegraph man. Well, I came here with a simple job to do, 'cause that news coming down the wire said your head's on fire, and I'm trying to get a message through to you. Oh, Ruby, you ain't lonely yet with your crystal and your Russian cigarette. You had before, 'cause the finest town when it hasn't got a door. So lick down your golden hair for me to climb. Lick down your golden hair for me tonight, just like in old times. Telegraph man, and I came here with a simple job to do, 'cause that news coming down the wire said that your bed's on fire, and I'm trying to get a message. get a message through to you.
It is a song from the album A Friend of a Friend. David Rawlings and Gillian Welsh are with me here in the studio. We've just heard Ruby. Ruby from the future. Because you haven't played it yet. As we sit here on Music Row in Nashville, it's a wonderful opportunity for us to just sort of get together for a few moments prior to your visit to Britain, where you're touring over the next few days.
Yes, we're very excited. The suspense of how that song that you just heard comes out is killing me. And,
I'm sure it's going to be great. <I'm
sure. laughs> But yeah, we're very excited to be hopping on a plane and flying over and getting to do some shows with our little band. We'd wanted to from the time the record came out, you know, when working with the schedules of the Crows and whatnot, it was going to be hard to find a time. And then when they booked this tour, it seemed like the perfect opportunity.
Yeah. So tell us a bit, you know, about the working partnership of you and the Crows and how it all came about.
Well, you know, Ketch Secor played fiddle at the first show we did at the Newport Folk Festival. You know, we booked a show under my name. You know, we wanted to play Newport. We were going to be there, but we didn't really want to play a full set of Gillian's material. You know, we wanted to sneak in a few songs that we were working on for her record without sort of playing the rest of the show. And we thought, oh, well, that'll be a fun way to do it. And Ketch happened to be up in New England, so he came down and sat in. But a lot of shows after that were just Gillian and I. We played by ourselves. And in fact, when we started recording, because it's what we knew how to do best, you know, we started recording as a duet quite a lot of the stuff. And some of it was successful and some of it we weren't happy with. And I found a little window of time when, you know, Morgan and Kevin and Ketch and Willie were going to be around. And I asked them if they wanted to come back down to Studio B, where we had, actually, that's where I had done the lion's share of their first record.
Yeah.
And we all thought it would be a great time to get back in there and try to record some more music. So they were willing. And that's when the record, not so much from a songwriting sense, because most of that was complete at the time, but from a sound of the record sense, that's when it started to gel. You know, first I set up very much like we're speaking here. We had vocal microphones set up for everybody, and we had little instrument mics, and I set it up sort of like I would record one of their records in a little semicircle, and we started singing. I think the first thing we tried was actually Ruby, and went into the control room and listened to it, and it was just god-awful. It just sounded terrible. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? You know, and because this was, at this point, I was sort of frustrated with where we were trying to record the songs with the two of us, and I thought, well, I guess maybe I'm just not going to be making this record. And I went out and I said, okay, well, let's work on the vocal parts. We'll sing a little bit. And we stood, and Willie stood across from me and catching my son Gil, and we all started to sing. And all of a sudden, I thought, well, this sounds fantastic, you know, as we all stood in this little tight circle. So we ended up just dropping a omnidirectional mic down in the middle of that, and off we went.
Yeah.
It kind of became the sound of the record.
Yeah.
Because RCA, the RCA studios, I mean, the vibe in there and the history and everything else, and it sort of matches in my mind with the whole ethos of the way you record, the two of you, and have done through the years in a very kind of organic way. I mean, I've got almost this picture of the two of you at home in the living room with a Revox in the middle of the table and a microphone. And
you're funnily enough, you're really not far off.
I mean, yeah, I was recording like that 2 days ago, but it was a Nagra.
But
what a great way to be able to record, to work on songs and work on material in that way.
Yeah, we don't really record with everybody isolated in their own little space. We're kind of the antithesis of that. We record close enough for everyone's sound to bleed into the other sound.
Yeah.
It's better that way with us.
And it's also interesting, you know, to watch the dynamic between the two of you, because, I mean, previously Gillian Welsh albums have been duo albums to that degree, but they've been given your name, Gillian, and now much the same process, but now it's the David Rawlings machine. So just explain that dynamic to us.
It came together fairly naturally from those earliest shows, which, as I said, weren't, you know, we weren't working with an idea that I'd make a record. But as we played that way, and particularly, I think what turned our minds towards it in a more focused way was when we did those early duet shows under my name. We realized that there was an energy and a different kind of sound that we were both interested in at that moment. And when we went back and did Gillian shows interspersed, we liked what we brought back to those shows from having played in this slightly different arrangement. And it was really remarkable to both of us that there was anything different going on if I just sang lead. Because in some cases, even on Gillian's records, you know, a song like, say, I Want to Sing That Rock and Roll, I mean, technically I'm singing the lead. Mm. I mean, we sing it in duet the whole time, so you won't know. but when that got written, yeah, exactly, don't tell the world.
Top secret. Yeah, that was Dave's on the lead part with that for how the song got written, and I'm on tenor.
Yeah, we just bumped
it
up.
It's duet throughout. So we snuck a few in over the years.
Yeah, there was another song that that's been around for quite a while where we sing together in unison, and that was a song that I ended up writing the music for it and was trying to sort of say, well, you know, we should sing it like this, and I was trying to sort of show her the way and like sing along with me, and then we heard the sort of unison vocal and we said, oh, let's just do it that way, and it was a lovely way to, again, sort of sneak it past.
Yeah. Because I remember when we were together at Melfest some years ago and you were doing the workshop stages and doing sort of Q&As about your music. And I remember a comment that somebody made that your songs, Gillian, the new songs, they've maybe only just been written or recently written, and yet they have a feel to them as if they've kind of been around and soaked up atmosphere and traditions through many, many years. And I remember you reacting very positively also to that kind of
sepia-tinted.
Yeah.
That's a big compliment to me. Yeah, if someone, in fact, I've gotten in arguments with people. I remember a interview early on, I guess when my first record came out, someone just flat out saying, you didn't write that song, about one of the songs on there. I'm like, yeah, I did actually. They're like, no, I've known that song for years. Mm. I'm like, no, I think we wrote it. But, you know, if it has that kind of a feel, if it resonates with people like that, that they feel that they've known it for years and they can't imagine that they got written this year, I think that's pretty good.
I think it's a byproduct of how much we're stealing.
Again, Dave, with all the secrets, I just...
But there's a warmth to all of that, though, Gillian, isn't there? That lovely reaction that you get to the songs.
I think part of what's coming through is how much I love traditional songs. They just keep on giving. Mm. Really, you can just go back to them and back to them, and they're just such deep and inexplicable folk poetry. And that's what I know we're always striving for, is something that you understand but you can't quite explain in the traditional songs. That peculiarity, and we call it peculiar language.
Yeah, or peculiar in terms of like a song that probably had 12 verses and four of them got remembered and the order got switched. And so you can sense the story, you can sense that there's something incredibly important going on, but your mind never gets tired of trying to figure out exactly what it was. And by and large, only the best language and the best verses have survived.
It makes them intensely personal and incredibly universal at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is the beautiful, beautiful thing about great folk music.
We should hear more of what you're about to record in London next week. So when you get there, what will the second song be?
Dave?
Well, something from the banjo would be nice. So we could either play To Be Young or It's Too Easy.
Let's play To Be Young.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
Wrong, and I got say, you gotta say, 'cause you gotta.
To be young is to be sad, is to be high. And the David Rawlings Machine with me in the studio here on Music Row, David Rawlings and Gillian Welsh. And I get the impression that at last Americana music is being genuinely recognized now as a real force within American music.
I feel like it has definitely gotten more attention in the past few years. I don't remember why I was talking about this with someone not that long ago, and Gillian and I were talking about how when we started doing this, you know, which is pretty much at the dawn of the Americana chart, you know.
The first year. This is when my first record came out.
I remember that we just truly felt when we made that first record, we didn't know anyone who was doing what we were doing. We didn't really know anyone else who was working in the same genre, if you will. I mean, we knew some older artists, but just not people of our own age. And I feel so differently about that now, you know, as the years have gone on. It's like now I know so many young people and people of our age, you know, who are doing a similar thing and who are having success. And, you know, there just seems to be a crowd has built, an audience has built for this music.
It's true, isn't it? Because old-time music as a music movement has now got so many subscribers.
Correct. You know,
the old Crow Medicine Show being one. But there are so many young, this is what I find exciting, so many young artists and young musicians are coming into this music.
Not long ago, I was in Manhattan hanging out with some young folks at 4 a.m. somewhere, and you know what, the guy I was with was, you know, just in an intense discussion of the Blue Sky Boys and, you know, and these the old time brother duets from the 30s and playing that music. And you could tell that, you know, this was the only music that this guy cared about. I think that it's been greatly influenced by how much easier it is to find the music now than it was a decade ago.
Yeah, I agree.
As soon as you find something that you like, it's all available to you. You can go online and find out.
It used to be people looked for years for a record.
Right.
Years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Trying to find a certain Reverend Gary Davis record. Years.
Right. I was talking to the Carolina Chocolate Drops, who were in our program just recently. You know, I asked them, how did you find a lot of this music? Expecting the answer to be that we delved around local libraries and little secondhand record shops and came across 78s. No. They said that we did everything online, researched it, found the material, did it all online.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. That and you know, their music could not be more authentic.
Yeah, it's amazing.
One of the other aspects of the two of you is people tend to make a pilgrimage towards you both, don't they? When they come into town. I mean, you have such a great, great, great reputation.
We like musicians and they like us.
Yeah.
It works out well. It's a good. Yeah, we have a lot of really cool friends and we keep meeting more people. It's really a happy thing for us that all these musicians we love, I don't know, they seem to like us too.
Yeah, they ring the doorbell.
They ring our doorbell,
in Nashville. But yeah, it's a wonderful thing. And having spent some time prior to making this record, spending a decent amount of time out in Los Angeles and meeting a whole new group of musicians out there as well, it's been a pretty sort of fertile last few years. It's been great.
So the next few years then, as you look forward, how do you see things now. Obviously, the first thing is the UK tour, but
well,
then what?
Well, and then we're back working on Gillian's record, which is sort of nearing...
It's about 80% done.
Yeah, something like that.
So that's pretty good. We're getting pretty close. So we have to come back and finish that, and then we'll probably do a little more touring at the end of the year. We haven't been touring very much this year for us, and we really like playing live, so we'll probably play a few more shows. And funnily enough, we've started writing songs for another record for Dave. We've got more songs, so we may be speeding up to rocket pace for us.
Right.
Well, let's play a final track from the album itself, David. And, you know, I'm not the only person in Britain who loves Bells of Harlem. There's a friend of mine called Mark Lamar, who has the Friday night program on Radio 2. And he's been playing the album generally, but that track specifically. Oh. And he absolutely loves that track, and so do I. Just tell us about it, to introduce it, you know, the strings and everything else. How did you sort of picture that as you began to record it?
We tried recording that as a duet for quite a while, and as we got further along with it, I also was having, you know, we went back and forth with having it almost parts of it spoken, and was trying to find something that would evoke the sort of early morning city feel that it had, you know, and the walking feel that it had. And, you know, we'd asked Carl Himmel to come up and to play drums, and he came and we played, and we, you know, we worked all day. We had a lovely time playing. And then the next morning, he was supposed to be driving home, and I just had the idea of, well, let's ask Carl to come back to the studio.
And Ben Mott was still in town.
Yeah, Ben was still in town, and we thought, well, let's take a little crack at Bells of Harlem with drums and maybe put Ben on Whirly, you know.
So Carl was literally packing his car.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, I got the drums in the car anyway to drive home. So he came back,
over
to the studio.
Which was great. And we sat down and just, you know, in a few little takes managed to get it. And it had a great feel, but it was very, very spacious. And at some point it occurred to us that, you know, we'd always wanted to put some strings on a track that this would, you know, suit the lyric and the emotional tone of it. And we contacted...
We're talking to Rick Rubin.
Right.
And I just asked him, I said, you know, Rick, we need some strings on something. Who comes to mind as an arranger? And he said, Jimmy Haskell. And then I felt like a moron for not, you know, thinking of him straight off. Jimmy is great.
I mean, he's done a lot of the Paul Simon and Simon and Garfunkel and Mamas and Papas and
yeah.
Ode to Billy Joe.
Yeah.
So he did the two string charts for us.
And it was a real recording thrill to, you know, we went to Capitol, and a magical thing to hear a small section. I mean, it was only 8 strings.
Because he said that's what he used on the Mamas and the Papas stuff. He's always used 8, and he thought this had the same kind of rootsy vibe. He's like, we're going to get it with 8. You don't need more than 8. I'm like, okay. That sounds good to me.
But to hear the strings in that room was just, you know, it was a real thrill, and in a room where you could put pretty much any microphone in any location, and you would just get a different flavor.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You would love it.
Well, listen, it's just been absolutely, it's been so good to see you both again.
Likewise.
And, you know, good luck with the UK tour.
Thank you.
And this is the closing track, actually, on David's album, and this is the very, very beautiful Bells of Harlem.